This is Fresh Air. When I interviewed Andrew Krieger yesterday, he had other things on his mind. He was watching his mini computer screen that was displaying up-to-the-second fluctuations in the currency market. I didn't take it personally. Krieger is always plugged into the market. His house is wired. His phone often rings in the middle of the night with calls about what's happening in the Asian markets. What he does is invest in currencies, dollars, yen, marks, speculating on which currencies will rise in value and which will fall. His new book is called The Money Bazaar, Inside the Trillion-Dollar World of Currency Trading. He runs his own company now, but when he worked for Bankers Trust in the 80s, he was considered one of the most successful young traders in the business. He's made, lost, and made millions of dollars in a market most people don't understand.
What I try to do is figure out what sort of structural changes can occur in the world's markets, which are going to cause a shift in what we call investor preferences to hold one currency versus another. Markets are always seeking some sort of state of equilibrium. So if you take that as your basic assumption, my job is to figure out where equilibrium theoretically would be at any one time and where that state of equilibrium is going to slide to.
When you're trading in international currency, is it a buy low, sell high type of thing? Is it the same, similar to the stock market?
Sure. In fact, one of the things I discuss in the book is that my concept of a currency is that it's very much akin to the stock of a country. So yes, I want to buy low and sell high, or sell high and buy low.
How is the currency similar to the stock in a country?
What goes into people's estimation of where a currency belongs relative to another is they have to look at the political structure, they have to look at the educational system, they have to look at the philosophies towards investments and savings and the practices towards investments and savings. They look at the military, they look at the natural resources, they look at the productivity, and all these different things sound very similar in a sense to measuring a value of a company. What kind of numbers is it producing? Are they producing big deficits or big surpluses? Are they generally profligate? Are they very tidy savers of their money and then smart investors? And all of these things are very similar to valuing a company.
But tell me exactly, what are you investing in when you put money into the currency market?
Okay. The funny thing about currencies, unlike stocks, stocks have an underlying entity, a company of some sort, right? And the company has some value, it has some assets, and it might have some, you know, some product that it's making or buying or selling. Currencies have no inherent value of their own. They only have a value on a relative basis. And so in a sense, it's a funny game because there's no inherent value for the dollar, say, or for the yen. It's always a relative value. So my job is to try to help people manage their currency exposures more efficiently. That is to say, if someone has to import goods from Japan, so they naturally therefore have a yen liability because they have to pay for these goods, and you know, with yen. Well, if the yen should strengthen dramatically, and they haven't covered their currency risk, then the fact is their company could go out of business from the currency fluctuations.
Wall Street of the 80s is now considered a symbol of greed and financial and materialistic excess. Did you feel like you were a part of that? I mean, you made a fortune trading currencies in the 1980s. You made $3 million in 1 year alone.
Well, I think if you consider my background prior to my Wall Street experience, then maybe to understand my own feeling was sort of sliding through somewhat objectively watching this process that I was perhaps in but not necessarily a part of. In terms of my identification, you know, I spent many years studying more esoteric things, you know, philosophy and Sanskrit and that sort of thing. And the currency game was an entirely new game for me. It was one which I fell into almost by accident. So when I got to Wall Street, I didn't really have any set of parameters or reference points, but I had this little screen that told me the currency rates were going up and down. So for me, it was just an intellectual game or process to figure out if I could somehow construct strategies which would be profitable.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Andrew Krieger, and he's a currency trader and consultant, and he has his own firm and is the author of the new book, The Money Bazaar, which is about the currency market. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Andrew Krieger is my guest, author of the new book, The Money Bazaar. If you could describe in layperson's terms one of the best investments that you've ever made, one that, you know, made a fortune for you?
The one that I got the greatest satisfaction from was the, it started with a somewhat amusing notion that I had this idea the early 1987 that the stock market was tremendously overvalued. By then, I was building up this notion that the U.S. had been very profligate and was building this pyramid of waste and sin and debt. And I said, well, if you're doing all the wrong things, the stock market really has to start coming down. And what I started doing was buying very, very inexpensive currency call options, priced to sort of in the November-December expiration time, which means that what I was betting on was that the dollar would start to decline very, very sharply between, say, the middle of August and the end of November or early December. And I bought these currency calls, and the market at that time had really been quite stable. So the options had a very, very low insurance premium or cost to them. And I just put it away, and the crash came, and the dollar started collapsing. And I remember sitting there, I had this feeling like somehow someone had handed me this key to the special little kingdom, and I was the only one allowed inside. And I had this feeling of like a grace somehow that I'd been given this gift, and I got to pick whatever I wanted. And it was a feeling that I didn't really feel that I had done anything so smart or intelligent. I felt, frankly, that yeah, there had just been this gift that someone bestowed upon me, that I had this idea, and it worked out absolutely perfectly and ended up making a couple $100 million on that play. And I said, well, gee, this is nice. I think I like this business.
But let me ask you, the collapse of the stock market and the collapse of the American dollar ended up being a gift for you, but how did you feel profiting so much at our country's disaster?
Well, the funny thing, and this is where the extent to which I'll say I was literally oblivious to some extent, maybe naive or maybe insensitive, but I felt, first of all, the stock market was built on, its rise had been built on all the wrong things. As I said, it built on greed and built on you know, terrible management of the government and all that sorts of stuff. So I said, well, hey, I think it's good to get a shakeout and get a clean out. And I really felt somehow that since I had no part in causing it, I was simply fulfilling my function, in a sense, doing my little duty as a trader. And I felt somewhat oblivious, really, or indifferent. Maybe that was insensitive, but that was what it was.
On the whole, you've made a lot of money, millions, right?
Yeah, on the whole, it's been quite profitable.
What do you do with your money?
Personal money?
Yeah. I mean, do you just keep reinvesting it, or are you living as wealthy a lifestyle as you potentially could?
Personally, I feel that I have a responsibility to add, well, let me put it differently. I look at myself something of a trustee for funds, whether someone's given me their own money to manage or whether it's my own money that's come to me. I feel that I'm a trustee, and my job is to somehow allocate to places where it's necessary. So I'm quite active in different sorts of service and charitable groups.
Can I ask you which charities you favor?
Well, one in particular I'm very active with is a group called Results,
mm-hmm.
which you may or may not be familiar with.
Not
yet. They have two components. One is it's sort of a grassroots lobbying group against hunger, and they're very, very active and quite successful in pushing certain types of programs, helping to push certain types of programs through Congress. And the other part is sort of, it's a result, it's an educational fund, which is really dedicated towards trying to educate people about hunger issues. It's not an organization where they say, you know, send us your money, we're going to make sure the people in Biafra, Ethiopia, whatever, get food. But it's actually a group that's dedicated towards really the education of people about hunger issues and trying to sensitize them to the hunger issues and basic you know, child survival issues and that sort of thing, until hopefully people will say, hey, this is really unacceptable. I'm going to do something.
This is going to sound like an incredibly stupid question to you, but I'm the kind of person who expects a receipt whenever I get anything or leave anything. You know, I mean, I can't believe that I can, like, leave my car at either, at say, the mechanics or something, and they don't give me a receipt saying
right.
that they have my car there, you
uh-huh.
know? So anyways, you're putting like zillions of dollars down on the telephone to invest in some currency.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this oral thing on the telephone. You have no evidence. You know, you can't...
It's shocking that it works. There are many, many people I've done billions of dollars of business with, and I've never met them. I don't know what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're tall or short or fat or old or what. But... It's one of the amazing things about the market. It's one of the things that intrigues me about the market, in that it's completely self-correcting. It's a market that, yeah, ultimately there's a transfer of funds, but it's built to a very, very scary degree on trust. And that's actually kind of a nice thing, sort of a redeeming quality, I think, in today's society, that someone can call up as a counterparty or representative of one institution to another and say, you know, make me a market on $200 million against the yen, and they can do a trade.
But did anybody ever hear you wrong or forget the message or anything like that?
Well, everyone has tapes on their machines.
Oh.
So there was only one instance that I can recall where I didn't have a tape on the machine when I first started trading at Salomon Brothers. And there was one counterparty I called up in Germany, and I asked him for a price on $20 million against the mark. And I sold the dollars. And just as I sold the dollars, he agreed to the price, he agreed to the amount. He said thank you, I said thank you, hung up. Bundesbank then came and intervened and sold dollars. The dollar dropped about 2.5% straight away. And I called him back and I said, well, you know, where's the dollar? He told me where. I said, well, I'd like to buy back the $20 million. He said, what do you mean buy back? I said, well, I want to buy back the dollars that I sold to you before. He goes, no, you didn't sell any dollars to me before. And we went to the tapes, which curiously had somehow been missing. They couldn't find them, and we didn't have a tape. And we ended up splitting the difference. It was the only time in 8 years that's ever happened to me that someone reneged on a deal.
Yeah. You know, I have a couple of friends who I really can't comprehend the work they do, you know. you know, when we get together for dinner and I say, so what's new at work? I really can't understand what they're telling me, you know, because it has to do with something very esoteric financially or whatever.
Right.
I wonder if you have friends who really can't comprehend what you do.
I have a wife that doesn't really comprehend very well sometimes. She was very happy when I finally decided to write the book. She said, well, now I see what you do. I mean, she just had this sense of, I mean, see, her perspective of my trading means getting phone calls at 3 in the morning and then 4 in the morning and then 5 in the morning and then occasionally hearing a telephone get slammed down because, you know, someone missed an order that they were supposed to execute. So her perspective is, gee, this is what work is, and she kind of misses the intellectual challenge of it that I go through. So I think for her, she probably shares some of your own experiences with some of your friends.
When you're trading these things that are like, you know, millions of dollars, and you're always dealing with millions of dollars, do you shop for things on sale or anything? I mean, what's the meaning of like a $25 purchase to you?
At first, when I was trading, I couldn't conceptualize like making the shift from trading. You know, I mean, there were times when I've done deals in excess of $1 billion, and so I had a little trouble conceptualizing going into the store and worrying about whether it cost $23 or $25.
Yeah.
And honestly, I was oblivious, but I was also working so hard I didn't really shop, so it didn't make any difference. It wasn't really an issue for me because I just, you know, I had my suits and I had you know, my wife was helping out with getting the food, and I didn't do any buying. So but it's something that it causes a warped perspective on life. There's no question, and you have to really sit back and say, "Hey, look, this is not real. You know, these $1 billion that I'm buying and selling, that's not reality. It's not the way most people think or live."
What kind of car do you drive?
I drive a Toyota.
You're kidding?
No, they make a great car. It's one of the Land Cruisers. We have 4 kids. So we need a big vehicle.
Yeah, the Land Cruisers cost, right? I mean, not like a Mercedes.
Not like a Mercedes, no. but they're bigger than a Mercedes, and they're a lot sturdier, I reckon.
Uh-huh.
And they gave me a 7-year warranty. I like that, and it helped my yen position a little bit because I bought a Japanese car.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
All right, thank you.
Andrew Krieger is the author of the new book, The Money Bazaar.